I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Doug Cohn, who's edited a new book called Broken Fragments, Jewish Experiences of Alzheimer's Disease. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The news from Israel has overshadowed pretty much all other Jewish discussion this week, and while this is the third time Israel has engaged with Gaza since the Hamas takeover 7 years ago, it seems qualitatively different somehow. In spite of Hamas's murderous best efforts, the actual casualties sustained by Israel to this point are very low, beginning with the three teenagers kidnapped and murdered in June, and the Israeli military seems to be hitting its targets in Gaza regularly. The Iron Dome missile defense system, built by the Israeli government defense company Rafael, has shot down virtually every rocket aimed at a population or military center in Israel, 90% that it's aimed at by most accounts, while the Israeli Navy has stopped a number of amphibious infiltration terrorist attacks. In general, the public mood in Israel is highly supportive of this fight. So, what is different this time around? Well, this is what many Israelis have heard this week. That was the sound of an air raid siren and the Iron Dome defensive projectiles launched at an incoming Hamas rocket last week. First, Hamas's rockets now have the range to reach the areas of Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, even Zichron Yaakov, much farther into Israel than they did, even 2 years ago. While they are reaching mostly open areas of land and being shot down by Iron Dome batteries when they threaten populated areas, this still requires Israelis to head for bomb shelters on a regular basis. Remember, Hamas and Islamic Jihad rockets cost as little as $800 to manufacture, while each firing of Iron Dome costs something like $20,000. But beyond the high financial cost, there is a sense of vulnerability that is permeating Israel. With school children all around the country forced to leave class and head for bomb shelters and bunkers, as they haven't had to do much since the Gulf War, perhaps, in 1991. And while most estimates say that Israel has destroyed 20% of Hamas's missile capacity so far, that still leaves perhaps 8,000 more rockets to be fired from Gaza at civilians. If the failed experience of the war with Hezbollah in Lebanon in 2006 is any guide, rockets continuing to fall on Israel demonstrates that any claim to victory will ring hollow. And within Gaza and the West Bank, the popularity of Hamas will remain strong and get stronger so long as they can continue to shoot these unguided missiles at civilian Jewish areas, no matter how miserable life becomes for Palestinians. While the Iron Dome, which wasn't in place nearly as completely in previous conflicts with Hamas, continues to minimize damage and casualties, the images and stories of Israelis and tourists forced to scramble to head for cover every time a siren goes off are disturbing. Our thoughts and prayers are with them. We hope for a speedy end to this episode in an ongoing encounter with Islamist fanaticism. There is another qualitative difference this time around. World opinion, always anti-Israel to a large degree, has become inflamed much quicker in this Gaza war. In spite of the fact that Hamas is internationally reviled and has burned its bridges with almost all of its sponsor nations, the sympathy for the people of Gaza seems greater than ever. While Hamas has now been kicked out of Syria and has lost all of its support from Egypt, The images of Gaza being struck by Israeli Air Force bombs are all over the internet and the TV. And the international support for the impoverished, vulnerable people of Gaza, never mind that they voted for and continue to support Hamas, and that they clearly are motivated primarily by the same hatred that has led them down this path several times before, nevertheless, the sympathy for the Gazans has been instantaneous and very strong. That international support for the Palestinians in Gaza has already turned violent. We'll report later in the show on incidents around the world. But in Paris, an Arab mob tried to invade and attack a synagogue filled with worshippers, something that really hasn't happened in Europe in years, and hasn't happened in France in quite this way since, World War II. Twitter hashtags like @HitlerWasRight and @HitlerDidNothingWrong trended among pro-Palestinians all around the world. And demonstrations in places like New York City and Seattle included chants of death to Israel, while in Los Angeles, pro-Israel protesters were attacked with sticks by Palestinians. Some of this is familiar from previous Israeli-Arab conflicts, but the instantaneous rocketing up of anti-Semitism, not just anti-Zionism or anti-Israel rhetoric, is, astonishing. Synagogues are being attacked. Jews are publicly accused of the blood libel again, on the web, of course, but even in public rallies in America. And there is a leap from concern over the mostly defenseless regular people in Gaza to flat-out anti-Jewish hatred. Of course, no nation would or should stand for rockets being fired into its population centers without retaliating and trying to stop them. As I've said many times, and said on this show last week, imagine if Mexico just started lobbing explosive rockets at Tucson, Phoenix, and San Diego, plus the nuclear facilities in Arizona and California. How long before we responded? And would America be so thoughtful as to alert all citizens living in the areas we plan to attack and request they move away from those areas as Israel has done in Gaza? And if Canada began shelling Seattle or Detroit or shooting missiles at Buffalo or New York City, how long before we attacked at Ottawa, Toronto, Vancouver, and Montreal? But those people who are protesting Gaza, and more importantly, those who believe that violent attacks on Jews in Paris or Brussels or everywhere in the world are now fair game, are not interested in fairness or balance. And they seem to have reached a level of vitriolic hatred of Israel, and in particular, all Jews, in an incredibly short period of time. I certainly pray for the end of this conflict. That requires Hamas to stop shooting missiles into Israel, the sole requirement Israel has for a ceasefire, which Hamas has often rejected. In fact, last week, the UNRWA Relief Organization discovered 20 rockets hidden in one of its schools in the Gaza Strip and vaguely condemned the group or groups responsible for placing the weapons in one of its installations, a flagrant violation of the inviolability of its premises under international law. This incident endangered civilians, including staff, and put at risk UNRWA's vital relief mission to assist and protect Palestine refugees in Gaza. Hamas and other Palestinian terror groups have no concern over endangering the people who are trying to help the Palestinian people, as long as it means they can fire a few more ineffective rockets into Israel in the hope they might kill Jews. You know, the embrace of peace and partnership brings short-term challenges in exchange for long-term success, prosperity, and hope. It is a hard road to take for a people, and in particular a leadership immersed in blood. But Mahmoud Abbas, at least the Fatah, appears to be trying to take that road. Is it truly impossible for Hamas to do so? To play us in this morning on the theme of peace, here is a prayer for peace from Congregation Yozma in Modin, Israel.
Eloheinu ve'eloheinu בשביל שנאה וקנאה וקנטור ושפיכות דמים.
That was A Prayer for Peace by Kehilat Yozma in Modin, Israel, which we just visited in June. May our prayers and theirs be answered soon. Alzheimer's disease affects many individuals and many families as well. Understanding the complexities of dealing with a debilitating and frightening loss of memory and identity is a crucial aspect of coping with Alzheimer's. Rabbi Doug Cohen has put together a powerful book on Jewish experiences, responses, and lessons about Alzheimer's. Learn about it when we come back on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Doug Cohen. His new book is called Broken Fragments, Jewish Experiences of Alzheimer's Disease Through Diagnosis, Adaptation, and Moving On. He previously edited a book about life, faith, and cancer, Jewish journeys through that painful experience. We welcome Rabbi Doug Cohen. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning.
So what prompted you to explore Alzheimer's in this new volume?
I actually was invited or asked to prepare this book. I was called one day by one of the contributors to the cancer volume who told me a story about his own mother and her illness with Alzheimer's and said, Doug, we need a book addressing Alzheimer's like we produced a book to address cancer. And I was busy on a different project and said, wow, he's right. So I called up my editor, made the suggestion and the proposal, and they loved it. And so I dropped what I was doing besides my regular work and pursued this. And I realized that there's a total lacuna, Sam, a total vacuum of Jewish resources and thinking on how we deal with this kind of concern. So this was written out of both the inspiration from my friend, the need to address it, and the sense that we need to find a voice in this area that's totally dark.
You know, when I think about the centrality of memory in Judaism, the focus on zichronam livracha, remembering people for blessing, remembering in general, memory is the source of redemption, the Baal Shem Tov says, and yet the loss of memory is such a tragic experience. Why have we kind of avoided this question for so long?
It's a good question. In my book, one of my favorite sentences is right in the very introduction where I write, memory is the currency of the Jew. And I think of that advertisement for one of the credit card companies, what's in your wallet? As Jews, we collect memory. We're in the memory business, individually, communally, and nationally. And so the very thought of loss of memory, either personally, communally, or nationally, is just beyond our imagination. And at the same time, we as Jews have always seen a human being as being a cognitive, intellectual focused being. Maimonides said a human being has to have cognition and has to have an intellect. So what happens when that dissipates? Is someone less of a human being? And that's one of the questions we ponder in the book. What happens to the humanity, to the personhood of one who's cognitive ability is waning. I think that we don't have an answer for that, Sam, and we try to approach that in the book. Can someone still be a human being if they cannot function? If someone cannot say Baruch Atah Adonai, can they still function as a Jew? If someone doesn't know those words or even know what words are, if someone speaks in grunts and the like, then do we accord them the same humanity as we would you and me? That set of questions hasn't been pondered. Yes, there are some questions about capacity in terms of legal issues about someone who's not mentally able, but those rabbinic questions were about the halacha of someone who had mental limitations, not someone who was fully able, who lost those capacities.
Right.
So this is a new field.
Interesting field. We will talk much more with Rabbi Doug Cohen about Alzheimer's. His book is called Broken Fragments, Jewish Experiences of Alzheimer's Disease Through Diagnosis, Adaptation, and Moving On, when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke International, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. What is Freedom Smoke International?
Thank you, Rabbi Cohen. Freedom Smoke USA is an electronic cigarette company based right here out of Tucson. We were the first store in the United States, the first store to have all FDA-approved products. It's a healthier alternative to cigarette smoking.
No smoke, no tobacco, and doctors refer people to you.
That's correct. My doctor actually just gave me a glowing report from other patients he's had that I've been able to find this as a healthier alternative to smoking.
Cardiologists, pulmonologists, even dentists, huh?
That's correct. It does help with all that.
How many flavors can people get of this?
We have over 700 flavors available.
Where are the locations and how do people get connected?
Our first location is at River and Orange Grove. We opened one at Broadway and Swan, and we currently just had our grand opening at 12th and Valencia.
And we do have a store in Southern Michigan also.
And what phone number can people call?
You can call the toll-free number at 1-800-705-7013. That's freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thank you, and we'll talk some more next week. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, we've had, in besides all of the news from Israel and Gaza and so on, somewhat lost somehow or other has been this remarkable, maybe terrible, change of events in Iraq with the development of something called ISIS, the Islamists sweeping east from Syria, maybe abandoning the Syrian civil war and proclaiming a caliphate. For most Americans, this is, I think, extremely puzzling. Can you clarify some of what the heck's going on?
Well, only to a limited extent, I'm afraid, because it's not all entirely clear or comprehensible to Westerners who like to think of themselves as rational. I can certainly talk about the history of the caliphate for a brief time.
Yeah, I mean, what's a caliph anyway?
Okay, so when Muhammad died in 632, his followers, and there
not
were a small
1400
group,
years ago.
Right, there were a small group of faithful followers wondered how he could be replaced, because not only was he the prophet who revealed the Quran, and by common consent among Muslims, the last of the prophets, the seal of the prophets. So he couldn't be replaced as a prophet, but as the leader of a nascent state that was about to expand dramatically, he could be and probably should be replaced. So a small council of elders met. They chose a guy who was a close relative of Muhammad's to succeed him as, in one Islamic tradition, God's deputy, and in the other, as the successor to God's deputy. That's interesting, too, because how do humans choose God's deputy? Clearly, only God can choose his deputy, but they can choose a successor to God's deputy. And so that became the mainstream Sunni tradition, that this council of elders, a shura, would meet and choose a successor. And the first four caliphs were chosen in the same way. That went to about the year 658, when a civil war emerged within the Islamic Empire, which had grown significantly by then, over whether the fourth caliph was really the right guy or whether he was implicated somehow in the assassination of the third caliph. Mm-hmm. Anyway, collectively, those first four were called the Rashidun, the rightly guided ones or the righteous ones. They were finally succeeded by a guy named Muawiyah, who was governor general in Damascus, the province of Syria, and who founded the first dynasty of caliphs, whereby the office became more or less hereditary. And that lasted about 50 years, from roughly 660 to 750, when there was a revolution that began in eastern Iran. Iran was always a revolutionary place in Islamic history. And also a distant relative of Muhammad's named Abu al-Abbas founded a new dynasty called the Abbasids. And the Abbasids moved the capital once again from Damascus to Baghdad, so further east. And the capital remained there for about 500 years till Baghdad was destroyed by the Mongols.
Genghis Khan or...
Right, those waves of invaders who destroyed lots of cities in Europe Tamerlane and Western Asia. And, right, exactly. Okay. So then the caliphate was in danger of disappearing, but in fact it was taken over by the Ottoman Sultan. And the Ottoman Sultan for centuries was the same person as the caliph and the leader of the Islamic religion and the Islamic empire. To be continued, I guess, next week.
We will. It's fascinating. And we zoomed all the way up to 19th century. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. President Obama was very curious about how the Jewish people knew everything before he did. So he called the CIA and the FBI and asked them to figure it out. 1 week later, the intelligence guys came back and said, "Mr. President, the Jews have something called Shabbos. They meet each other at the synagogue and they use a code. They sit, they pray, and before they talk confidentially, they have a special prompt, a word that's the key to this secret. That word is nu. When one Jew says to another, nu, the other tells him everything, every bit of news." Well, President Obama wanted to see this for himself. So the FBI dressed him up like a chassid, taught him to read from right to left in the siddur. The president arrived at a synagogue on Shabbos and sat beside Izzy. He waited for a few moments and then said, "Nu?" And Izzy answered, "Shh, don't talk now. Obama is coming." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Maaseh includes the final chapters in the Book of Numbers, and the concluding section of Bamidbar, an important and unusual institution is created, the City of Refuge. In the days before police forces and criminal courts existed, justice in cases of manslaughter or murder was typically accomplished solely by the family and the kin of the victim. What we would probably consider vigilante action was the normal means to address the moral and social disruption created by a murder. If you killed someone, intentionally or accidentally, or even if the family of a person who was killed thought you did the killing, you would likely be killed by their kinsmen. It was the Hatfields and the McCoys. Kill and you will be killed, and then your family will avenge the killing and the other family will respond, and on it would go. That meant that if you happened to be involved in such a terrible situation, you had very little chance to stay alive, even if the killing was accidental and even if you were innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in a revenge killing, it wouldn't help much. And so, in the portion of Maaseh, the Torah provides for six cities of refuge in and around the land of Israel. No person who enters these cities may be executed without a fair trial. Being present in the City of Refuge is a kind of protection, a guarantee of due process that has become central in modern law, but was mostly absent throughout human history. Yet the Torah established that principle some 3,000 years ago. Perhaps even more importantly, in this section of Maaseh, the central requirement to try a capital case in Jewish law is established. A murderer may not be put to death, save by the eyewitness testimony of two adult witnesses. This is a much more stringent standard than used by any death penalty court in America today. Murder, the deliberate taking of human life, is the most serious of crimes and must be fully punished. But in Jewish law, that punishment can only be meted out after a careful, balanced, rational process. The use of lynch mobs is outmaneuvered by creating cities of refuge. Proper witnesses must be secured to give impartial evidence. A trial of law before appropriately qualified judges must be instituted before any punishment for murder may be applied. While halacha provides for the death penalty in cases of premeditated murder, it makes it extremely difficult to enforce that punishment. The Mishnah teaches that a court that passes a death penalty once in 7 years is considered bloodthirsty. Other prominent rabbis extend that to once in 70 years, or even ever. In other words, the ultimate punishment must be reserved for a nearly perfect case. Otherwise, only lesser forms of remediation can be applied. And since we are human, our cases are usually far less than perfect. Jewish law makes it clear that justice, especially for the worst crimes, must be careful, exacting, and scrupulously ethical. Good lessons, 2,500 years ago in Israel, and good lessons today. Alzheimer's disease affects many individuals and many families as well. Understanding the complexities of dealing with a debilitating and frightening loss of memory and ultimately identity is a crucial aspect of coping with the disease. Rabbi Doug Cohen has put together a powerful book on Jewish experiences, responses, and lessons about Alzheimer's. Learn about it when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Three Israeli suspects in the revenge kidnapping and murder of the Palestinian teen were indicted in Jerusalem District Court last week. The indictment filed in the murder of Mohammed Abu Khader, 16 years old, of Shuafat in East Jerusalem, charged the unnamed suspects with murder and kidnapping, as well as other crimes. The names of the suspects remain under court-ordered gag order. They are identified as a 29-year-old man from the Adam settlement outside of Jerusalem and two 16-year-olds, one from Beit Shemesh, one from Jerusalem. Khader was kidnapped from outside a mosque in his neighborhood early on the morning of July 2nd, hours after the funerals for three Israeli teens who were kidnapped and murdered, probably by Hamas, 2.5 weeks earlier. Khader's badly burned body was found hours later in the Jerusalem forest. According to the indictment, Khader was beaten unconscious and then set on fire while still alive. The three suspects, who reportedly reenacted the horrible crime, have confessed and said it was in revenge for the kidnapping and murder of Gilad Shar, Naftali Frankel, and Eyal Yifrach. Khader's murder touched off rioting in Arab areas throughout Israel. The indictment that was filed details a grave and shocking act perpetrated against a background of racism against an innocent teenager, Israel's Attorney General Yehuda Weinstein said. The Attorney General wishes to express his deep sorrow over this cruel act that counters all basic human morals. Opposition to Israel's offensive against Hamas in the Gaza Strip has led to violence against Jews in the diaspora, turning those unconnected with the conflict into a convenient proxy target in place of Israel, especially in Europe. Attacks against Jews by anti-Israel demonstrators since the start of the Gaza offensive July 8th have been used as excuses for those who hate Jews in order to vent their anti-Semitic hatred in an attempted lynching, Moshe Kantor, the president of the European Jewish Congress, said last week. In a statement in response to an attack on a Parisian synagogue last week, he added that those involved in such incidents are using the current conflict between Israel and Hamas to attack Jews. Absolutely true. Last Sunday, a mob surrounded the Synagogue de la Roquette in Paris, trapping its occupants inside and fighting with security guards and later police. Three members of the Paris Jewish community ended up in the hospital. The attackers splintered off an anti-Israel demonstration and advanced towards the synagogue when it was full, said Alain Azria, a French Jewish journalist. When the demonstrators arrived at the central Paris synagogue, the five police officers on guard blocked the entrance as the protesters chanted anti-Semitic slogans and hurled objects at the synagogue and at the guards. Hundreds of congregants inside were joined in a Jewish religious service that had been called to pray for peace in the Middle East. The anti-Semitic rioters were determined to enter, and the police did not have enough forces, said the journalist. The mob was initially held back by volunteers from the SBCJ Jewish Community Protection Service, the Jewish Defense League, and Beitar, who engaged the attackers in what later turned into a street brawl. Thank God they were there, because the protesters had murder on their minds and it took a while before police reinforcements arrived, said a witness. The fact that a synagogue full of worshippers was a chosen target demonstrates that the mob's primary hatred is for Jews, and the Jewish state is an extension of that, said Kantor. We should not allow any conflicts in the Middle East to be hijacked and imported as a vehicle for violence. He added that, following a meeting with French President François Hollande last week, he is confident that the French government is working hard to prevent anti-Semitism and to assure the safety and security of the Jewish community. In another Paris attack, a man pepper-sprayed the face of a 17-year-old Jewish girl. Also in France, in Belleville, north of Paris, a firebomb was hurled at a synagogue, causing minor damage. By some accounts, 75% of Jews in France are considering emigrating now, with the French Jewish population in Israel rising fast. A new draft bill unveiled last week would ban French citizens suspected of ties to jihadist networks from leaving the country. It's aimed at those going to Syria to fight as jihadis. It drew praise from the World Jewish Congress. How it would be enforced remains unclear. In addition to the Paris rioting and other attacks, dozens of men at an anti-Israel demonstration in Antwerp shouted slogans about slaughtering Jews. About 500 people attended a protest in the capital of Belgium's Flemish region last week, where one of the speakers used a loudspeaker to chant a call in Arabic that means "slaughter the Jews." The Belgian League Against Anti-Semitism filed a complaint for incitement to violence against participants and organizers of the Antwerp demonstration, dozens of whom were recorded making such anti-Semitic calls. International politics cannot serve as a pretext for incitement to anti-Semitic hatred, said the organization's president, Joel Rubenfield. He also condemned the presence at the demonstration of three local politicians, Karim Bahar of the Flemish Socialist Party, Ikraim Kastit of the Flemish Green Party, and Mohamed Chabah of the Labour Party. The protesters shouted, "Jews, remember Khaybar, the army of Muhammad is returning," referring to a 7th century slaughter of Jews in Saudi Arabia. 7th century. Earlier this month, that same call was heard in Holland at a demonstration in The Hague in favor of the ISIS Sunni militia that is marauding through Syria and Iraq. The protest was held 6 days before Israel launched its military operation in Gaza. That's 6 days before. The Simon Wiesenthal Center, in a letter to Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, protested that the demonstration was allowed to take place. "Unless jihadism in your country is totally quashed, Dutch returnees from their Syrian baptism of fire and jihadist websites at home will menace Jewish, Muslim, and all other citizens of the Netherlands," wrote Shimon Samuels, the center's international relations director. Moshe Ahayon, a Moroccan rabbi, was beaten up over Gaza in Casablanca last weekend as well, and several people described being assaulted during a protest in Boston last week, which drew condemnation from the ADL. The Anti-Defamation League called the accounts of assaults and anti-Semitic name-calling at the protest, including, this is the Boston protest, including the use of the term Jesus killers, disturbing. "People of good faith everywhere should regard this conduct as an affront to decency," said Robert Treston, New England regional director of the ADL. In Seattle, there were similar protests and similar kinds of comments. And in Eugene, Oregon, swastikas were painted on mailboxes in front of the A.E. Pie Fraternity House at the University of Oregon. The swastikas were painted on all the mailboxes in front of the Alpha Epsilon Pi Fraternity, an officially Jewish house, according to a report filed with the Eugene police last week. The fraternity informed the dean of students of the attack as well. In the interest of full disclosure, I was an A.E. Pie, I guess I am still, at UCLA and a chapter advisor at UC Santa Barbara. The police do not have any leads in this case. Anti-Semitic and other discriminatory graffiti hasn't happened a lot in Eugene in recent years, said a police spokeswoman. Swastikas were painted on the back door of the A.E. Pi Fraternity House several years ago. The City of Eugene's Human Rights Commission strongly condemns these types of hateful actions, said Phil Carrasco, a member of that commission. The symbol comes from a place of hate and is used to promote hate. Indeed. Andy Gittleson, the executive director of the Oregon Hillel, says there is a heightened sensitivity to the graffiti due to Israel's current military operation in Gaza. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Doug Cohn. His book is called Broken Fragments, Jewish Experiences of Alzheimer's Disease Through Diagnosis, Adaptation, and Moving On. Previously wrote a very interesting and important book called Faith and Cancer, Jewish Journeys Through Diagnosis, Treatment, and Recovery, based on his own personal experience as a cancer survivor. Rabbi Cohn, sorry, I just have to call you Doug. I can't think of anything else.
That's okay, Sam.
I got to know you when we were both able to be good runners, which is one of the things that you lose over time. Tell me a little bit about the experience of loss and how Alzheimer's creates that sensibility and what those kinds of experiences have meant in preparing this book.
You know, Sam, we lose things in life. It's the nature of aging. It's the nature of life. You and I both used to run more swiftly than we do today.
Yes, considerably.
Today we're a day older than we used to be. But that's something which we expect and we anticipate. Losing our keys. I mean, I've lost my keys 1,000 times. I'm sure every one of us has. But we know if we lose our keys, we put them down, we'll find them. The question is, what happens when we lose something which is integral to our being? such as our mind, our own self. What happens when someone no longer recognizes their dear ones? Then loss is not simply, where do I put the keys, I'll find them and I'll move on. Or then loss is not diminishing capacity of running, but not diminishing my self and my humanity. When we're talking about cognitive impairment in Alzheimer's, we're discussing the loss of that which makes someone intrinsically a person, and that's also a loss which cannot be regained. Somebody who can't run can perhaps walk or swim or perhaps get a replacement knee or a hip and can be vibrant again. But this is something which entails a permanent loss and a loss that renders those around them helpless. So it's a completely different category of losing.
When someone is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, it's a devastating diagnosis, devastating for the individual, devastating for the family. Talk a little bit about the Jewish sort of approach to that initial experience.
We live in a world of support systems in the Jewish world. We live with communities, with minions, we live with families. And so the natural response to knowing that someone is in early stage of Alzheimer's is to circle and support, to engage the individual and the family as much as possible while there is still time, because we know there's an insidious downward spiral. Yes, there are plateaus, but it all goes down. And so there's this urgency. There also is another really difficult experience here, and that is there's a silence, there's a stigma. And that's one of the reasons why this book was so vital, because it gives voice where there's silence. But all too often, when someone is diagnosed, the family is quiet. There's an embarrassment. There's a worry that so and so will forget family, or will be at a restaurant and not know how to use a fork and a spoon. So there's a silence. And I think in the Jewish community, in synagogues like yours and mine and elsewhere, we need to do a better job of creating an openness, a respite world, an opportunity to connect with resources, to let the synagogue be there in the good times and in the difficult times. There's no other systemic response, but there's this emotional response. And we have to be able to validate that. And also, I think the big concern is being supportive for the caregiver, who otherwise can be absorbed totally by the new demands that this places upon them. So it's really a communal response here.
Now, the caregiver is often forgotten in this experience. There's an initial wave, as you said. People tend to circle around, and while we should remain engaged, because the pace of this kind of disease varies, some people it goes very quickly, some people much more slowly. As a Jewish community, how do we cope with the challenge of staying engaged with someone who's both on that downward spiral and then the caregivers who are trying to provide that support?
It's a good question. There are many, many answers, and I'm pleased that there are quite a few creative responses that one will find in broken fragments. In many communities, the Jewish Center provides great respite opportunities for drop-off, drop-off moments when the programs and social workers and the like will be able to welcome individuals on a day-by-day or hour-by-hour basis. There are also wonderful stories of some JCCs and some Jewish homes that are doing great programming with dementia patients in arts, in crafts, in music. We write in the book about the JCC in Los Angeles and a private individual who runs home arts programming for homeschooled children. And he got together the seniors at the JCC and the children from the arts program, and they went to the Los Angeles Art Museum, and the kids and the adults are walking hand in hand looking at the art and talking together. It was a beautiful experience. So I think that what we need to do is think creatively and think somewhat, to use a cliche, out of that box, because otherwise we get boxed in with Alzheimer's. We need to look at how our organizations can use resources and use volunteers to help. Otherwise, all too often, like you said, the caregiver becomes trapped, and then they become embittered and endangered. But there are resources.
How do synagogues adapt? I mean, we both are congregational rabbis. I have the experience of seeing people who are there. A man in my congregation showed up for services, Shabbat morning services, on a Wednesday. You know, things like that start to happen, and you begin to realize there's a problem.
Well, that does speak to one unique aspect of Alzheimer's and dementia, and that is that the Alzheimer's individual or patient lives in a timeless universe, that time and yesterday and tomorrow, which govern your life and mine, don't govern their lives. So Wednesday may be a perfectly fine Shabbos. What I would say is, I would say to this gentleman, I'd say, Murray, come. It's you and me. Let's sing and let's daven together. Right. And I would validate instead of invalidate. And I think that's what the synagogue can do. We need to be able to welcome. We need to be able to say to this individual, sure, and to the family, you know what, maybe we'll have Shabbos for Alzheimer's patients or dementia patients on Tuesday or Wednesday. We also need to be willing to accept when someone is in the synagogue and they're lost. If there's someone in my congregation who just doesn't follow the pages anymore, and so I'll step off the bima and walk over and turn the page and give them a little smile and do it again and do it again, or announce the page, and just do that with love and with care. I think we have to recognize that Alzheimer's will teach us all to be far more patient, far, far more patient. Because, frankly, someone may ask the same question a dozen times. To you and me, it's a dozen questions. To them, each one is a separate question because they don't recall the last one.
Right.
So it really does teach us to look at someone in a whole new way.
And teaches us patience, which is not always a Jewish virtue.
Not a Jewish... It's a Jewish virtue, just not a Jewish practice, I guess.
Not a Jewish habit.
No.
How... you know, it seems to me that everybody knows someone who has been affected by Alzheimer's, and many of us, of course, know lots of people who have been profoundly affected by it. What kinds of education need to be done, and what emerged in the course of preparing your book?
Some good questions. I think that we have to recognize that the person with Alzheimer's is still a person. That's the first thought in the book, and the last thought in the book, is that these people still have dignity, and they still have emotional needs. Someone who may not be able to express themselves verbally still needs a hand to be held, still needs a smile, still has emotional yearning for love and for being cared for and for affection. And sometimes we find it too difficult to be in their presence because we can't sit and have a conversation. We become bored, they become bored, and so it's not valued, and so we depart. I think that, again, going back to patience and recognizing that these are still people will perhaps liberate us to treat them wholly and better. And secondly, in terms of what we could learn here, there's a question about what's a human being? What is a soul? What really comprises a person? Does someone who doesn't have a mind still have a soul? As we begin to ask these questions, we begin to realize that we've limited ourselves. And one of my writers suggests that we can learn more from these people than we can learn from anywhere else, that these are really almost godly human beings because they live in a world not governed by food and time. They live in a world of spirit. And if we pay attention and really pay attention to them, we can be touched. So that's what we could learn is... you know, we're not going to learn anything new. We're not going to learn anything cognitive. They're not going to teach us about physics or math. But we can look at, see a person, and we may not get that somewhere else. That's the gift of this person who's lost their mind but still has a soul.
Fascinating. It's sort of a concept of seeing, living in a spiritual level because the pragmatic pieces are gone.
Exactly, and the time pieces are gone. They live in an atemporal universe. The question is, we don't know how to live there. They do it by default. And so we need to suspend our rationality to be able to have a conversation. One of the great chapters in the book is called Talking to Alzheimer's. How do we talk to someone who can't have a conversation? Well, we just have to listen, and we say the same thing again and again, but we speak with a smile and with a warm touch and with a twinkle in the eye, as opposed to discussing what was in the New York Times yesterday. They don't care about that. So we have to learn to listen and talk in a whole new way.
What does it mean to move on from Alzheimer's?
That's not the That's not where we want to go, actually. That's a euphemism. We were toying with what's the third part of this book. The first part is diagnosis. The second part is adaptation. What comes next? And what comes next really is ultimate loss, is loss and death. And there's no return, unlike with cancer, where there may be remission or recovery. So that title of that last section was offered by my friend and yours, Rabbi Richie Address,
mm-hmm.
when we were designing the book. And I said, Richie, I didn't know what to call the last section.
And another past guest of Too Jewish, I might add.
Yes, and he also wrote a chapter for this book and the back cover testimony to my first book. And Richie came up with this idea saying, moving on really means that we have to find a way to let them move on as we move on. It may entail some very gutsy decisions. In fact, Richie wrote the chapter regarding a spouse of someone who has Alzheimer's. What if he or she is lonely and still married to their spouse who's no longer cognitive, and they opt to have some other romantic relationship? Does it count as adultery if one is lonely and needing affection and needing companionship, but whose spouse is not functioning? So this question, and it's fascinating because today, and you and I have seen it in our synagogues,
of course,
there are many such individuals who will not divorce their diminishing spouse because it's demeaning, yet at the same time, they're still alive. So moving on means making some very tough decisions about how we're going to live with family, with friends, and welcoming a new kind of relationship sometimes in our life.
You know, I've had exactly that question asked to me, looking for sort of rabbinic permission.
Mm-hmm.
It's a challenging and an interesting question.
Exactly. And I trust that you've given that generous message that there's law and there's law.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's love, and there's different ways of expressing that love and support. Fascinating set of subjects, issues that will not go away anytime soon, in fact, seem to be increasing in their importance. And great book that helps people understand the dimensions of some really fascinating Jewish issues, but also compassionately dealing with the question of Alzheimer's. I want to thank Doug Cohn for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His book is called Broken Fragments, Jewish Experiences of Alzheimer's Disease Through Diagnosis, Adaptation, and Moving On. Available, of course, on Amazon and everywhere books are sold. Doug, thanks so much.
It's always a privilege to be with your listeners. Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning here on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Cheryl Berkner Mack, one of the crucial individuals involved in Women of the Wall, updating us on what's going on with that important group. Our playout this morning comes from the popular Israeli rap group Hadag HaNachash, Serpent Fish. It's called Shalom, Salam, Peace. We sing and pray and hope for it to come back to Israel speedily and soon. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
שלום סלם פיס, אפשרי גם כאן לא רק בפריס, או בניס, או באבא באדיס קוטקים מלאים אנשים כולם דנסים, כי כולם מצודים מחייכים רוקדים שרים, בשלום מברכים כי יש שלום סלם פיס שלום סלם פיס שלום סלם פיס, שלום סלם פיס שלום סלם פיס, אפשרי גם כאן לא רק בפריס, בתוניס, או בניס, ניס, ניס האויבים נניס, האיבה נמיס, האימה נביס אהבה נפיץ אבל אם כבר חייבים, אז לא עדיף בליווייס במקום במדים בעזרת העצב, נחפף את העצב, כולם יכולים לרקוד עכשיו, נחפף בטוב בקר